From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. The novelist Joanna Hirshon is my guest. Her novels include Swimming, Outside of August, and The German Bride. Her latest book is A Dual Inheritance. She joins us now from a faraway land called New York City. Joanna Hirshon, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Is it actually snowing there today, or what?
It is on the cusp of snowing. I think the snow is about to start.
All right, well,
it was snowing before, and it's going to snow again.
It's New York. It's very warm here in California, by the way.
I know. Rub it in, why don't you?
Now, the world hates spoilers, so why don't you tell us what we need to know about A Dual Inheritance, and then we'll talk about it.
Oh, that's a tough one. Well, this is a book that in many ways is about tribalism, but it starts in 1962 when Ed Kantowitz and Hugh Shipley meet in their final year of Harvard in the fall, and the first part of the book is in the early 60s, and it spans about 50 years, and it's a multi-generational novel, and their friendship is the catalyst for the heart of the book, I would say. And their friendship is brief, and it ends abruptly, and only one of them really understands why the friendship ends, and it comes kind of full circle in a way by the end of the book.
All right. Well, you've told us the entire. You told us the ending, so we don't have to worry about spoiling anything.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Now your first three books, they were kind of more intimate sort of books, and this book is, it's this big multi-generational saga. And you seem to know what you're talking about in your book. Like, you talk about the financial world and Africa. Did you make all that stuff up?
Thank you. I did a lot of research and a lot of really. It's funny, but what I love when people tell me about this book is that it is a saga, but it's actually on a very intimate scale. So even though it does go all around the globe and it covers real like themes and ideas and issues, the actual experience of reading it is very intimate. So, and I did a lot of research. I kind of called this book my crackpot anthropology project because I did a lot of interviews with people and really delved pretty deeply into people's lives in some cases. And certainly the financial sector in the 60s as well as the 80s as well as the present day, I did a lot of research. But mostly I read a lot, but mostly through interviewing people and listening to their stories. That was the main part.
Well, I'm interested in the process of how you would go about writing a book like this. Now, you kind of mentioned that it's about kind of the tribe aspect, the kind of the conflict of these two tribes. But so I'm assuming maybe that's what you wanted to write about, or you had a story, and then you realize that, well, there's going to be these other aspects that I need to research, or what? How does it happen that you wrote about, how did you write this book?
Yeah, it's really a sprawling book. It started with, it's only kind of, for me, it's really at the end of a writing process, or certainly in the middle, that I really feel like I understand like what a book is about. It's more like it grows from various seedlings, and at a certain point, certain themes become more conscious, but you know, it started with several kind of little feelings or seeds, and one of it was kind of an interest in male friendship and my father's friendship in particular with his very close friend. But it's in no way about those people. Do you know what I mean? It sort of started with thinking about becoming unlikely friends and male friendship, and also a period in time. I started writing this book before Mad Men came out. And, it's funny. I remember watching a whole season of Mad Men and thinking, why am I so interested in this? So
I'm writing a book about it.
I could not It was such a different world from what I was writing about that it didn't occur to me after. But I've always been interested in the early 60s and the late 50s and this kind of period of time that seemed, as someone who was not alive then, I think I've just always been preoccupied with how certain decades become the next decade. You know, we're taught there's like the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, and that's not really true at all. So it's a,
right.
You know, it's a construct that historians
that we officially
create,
put on
social...
it. Yeah, but we artificially put on it. But at the same time, you know, especially the 60s, they definitely had their own, you know, its own kind of thing happening. But I think the 60s didn't really start until maybe 63.
Like 68, later.
And it lasted until maybe halfway into the 70s or something.
Yeah, and I think as a kid, trying to figure out from the images and stories how, you know, 1967 seemed to be so different from 1965, let's say. You know, and I remember my mother graduated from college in 1967, and she said when she came back a year later, you know, there were all these huge changes that had happened, and, you know, that just seemed always kind of amazing to me and fascinating. And also my parents are 8 years apart, and my father has always seemed like such a product of the 50s, and my mother such a product of the 60s. So that always was, I guess, an interest to me. But I didn't realize all this consciously until recently. Those sort of abstract ideas.
You knew you wanted to write about male friendship as opposed to female friendship.
I did. I mean, the book is also about female friendship.
Right, because there's two.
Without giving too much away.
There's two sets of
friends. I was interested in how, in both kinds, and there's definitely conscious choices I made about the male friendship and the female friendship in this book, and playing with ideas about generations and class and gender, and, you know, all of these ideas. Ideas came out of these interests, I guess.
Well, Joanna Hirshon, if you wanted to write about the financial world, then you could do some research in the financial world. But if you want to write about male friendship, how do you research that? I mean, people want, even if you interview people, will they necessarily reveal what you need to know?
That was more of an intuitive process. The question that most people ask me about this book is how I write so convincingly from a male point of view.
Uh-huh.
And I've never really thought about it. This character Ed Kantowicz, we get Ed's point of view, and we also get Hugh Shipley's point of view, and both felt incredibly comfortable to me to write. And my other books maybe aren't as obviously about men. Two out of my other three books have significant male points of view. So I don't know. I've just always been, I guess, interested in men. I've always known men and had great different intimate relationships. And it just seems like, why wouldn't I write from a male point of view? I don't know how else to explain it, but mm-hmm. It felt very natural. I mean, it certainly wasn't an academic idea, sort of, you know, following my interest in male friendship. It was more grew out of the characters I was interested in, and some of the kind of depth of feeling that it, to my mind, isn't necessarily expressed as much with male friendship as opposed to female friendship. So that did drive some of my interest.
When you actually sit down and do the writing of your book, or any of your books, do you always know where you're going, or does it sometimes just, oh, look what this guy said, or look what he did?
Such a great question, and it's so... it's hard sometimes to remember, you know. Sometimes I think, oh, I always knew that, but I think I had more of a sense with this book of where it was going than I have with some of my others. But there were tons of surprises along the way. So mm-hmm. it was a combination. I always knew that this book would have the scope of a lifetime, you know, or at least many, many years, because that was my interest in kind of memory and time passing. And that's what I love a lot about writing fiction and what you really can do, I think, specifically with fiction writing as opposed to film or music or playwriting, you know, is the way that you can play with time and you can speed time up and slow it down, and, you know, decades, centuries can pass in a paragraph, and, you know, a whole book can be 5 minutes. So I think that's really fascinating to play with and really compelling for me. You know, this idea of seeing someone after a long period of time and their presence being so familiar and, you know, time really not having passed between the two of you. That's something that I just relate to and wanted to capture. So I knew it would take it would feel like a sprawling, long book. And, you know, hopefully you get to the end and you feel nostalgic for the beginning. And you feel older with these characters. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I didn't necessarily know how I would get there.
So you knew the beginning and the end, but the middle happened as you were writing.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, you mentioned Mad Men. Nowadays, you know, television has, you know, accomplished so much in the recent television series.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that this would be a cool, you know, I don't know, miniseries.
I completely agree. I mean, from your lips to Hollywood's ears.
Yes, if they're listening.
I mean, I know. I mean, that's what I really think it would be a fantastic miniseries or television series.
Yeah.
Not as much a film, but it does have an episodic kind of quality and a lot of, I think, really interesting minor characters. It has a really big cast of characters.
Yeah.
And hopefully you grow to care about a lot.
Yeah, well, absolutely, you do.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the tribe aspect of your
mm-hmm.
of your story, the Capulets and the Montagues, the the Jews and the Goyim. What?
Yeah, that's really what it is.
Are you a member of a tribe?
Well, I'm Jewish. I grew up not religious, but definitely in a Jewish family. Pretty, you know. I'm always hesitant to say typical because I feel like typical to one person is atypical to another, but I'm definitely Jewish. And I'm married to someone from more of the Hugh Shipley, the not Jewish person. So my family is a blend, and my own family now is a, you know, blended tribe, blended from different backgrounds.
Do you find things with your husband that there's just, even though you guys are mated and all, there are some parts that he just doesn't get because he's not Jewish?
You know, I feel like less than, we're far more kindred, not only as, you know, romantic people and husband and wife, but I think we see things kind of with a shared perspective. But certainly there's some things that, you know, it's just different.
Yeah.
It's just a different upbringing. So, of course, you know, so we bring different perspectives.
Okay, but do you think...
to the world.
Do you think... I mean, I think, you know, that's true with any husband and wife, right? They both had different upbringings, and so therefore...
Yeah, of course.
But do you think there's something specific about being a Jewish person?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah, for sure.
That you laugh at things that he doesn't laugh at and so forth?
No, that's one thing I think that our sense of humor is definitely shared.
Uh-huh.
And I think that I definitely feel like maybe he's got a Jewish sense of humor. I don't know. It's that I don't think. I've heard a lot of other people talk about that, like, you know, laughing at certain things. I think that actually is pretty similar.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I feel like that's a whole other book to write about or a whole other conversation. Like, what really is it? That's different, but there definitely is. It's a certain way of looking at the world, a certain way of feeling connected to ancestors, maybe. I don't know. It's definitely different.
Well, have the people who, now you've been touring around and you've been doing readings and meeting people who have read your book, have people from these two tribes connected with you and let you know how they feel about the book? Have you gotten reactions?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Which has been really satisfying. And the best has been, you know, people I've interviewed, and have, you know, obviously gotten their approval to use whatever they share with me in whatever fictional way that I want to. When those people have said, you know, expressed just delight or different positive feelings about reading their stories refracted in my fiction. So that's been really satisfying, and kind of feeling like I was able to take their perspectives or, you know, shared stories and make it something that they, you know, deeper than what they were trying to express, or one case, like, I was less judgmental of a situation than they were. They had so many strong opinions, and my perspective was just more nuanced, I guess, and they really loved that. So that was really satisfying. And definitely, you know, people from certain worlds I'm writing about contacting me and saying, how do you know this? You know, you weren't even born. Or just feeling, you know, men, a lot of men contacting me, like older men, saying, how could you capture my life? This is just, I relate so much. You know, I worked on Wall Street in the 60s, and it was just like that. Or, you know, different people have contacted me, strangers, which has been great. And especially from the older generation and from a male perspective, because both things are not inherent to my experience, of course.
We're talking with Joanna Hirshon, and her latest novel is called A Dual Inheritance, and she's just told us that she's been contacted by a lot of strange older men. I'm not taking that out of context, am I? No. This is your fourth novel, right? Swimming,
yes.
Outside of August, The German Bride. Are you like a person that has just a zillion stories that are rambling around inside your skull and you can't wait to get them out?
No, I'm totally not. I joke that I have one idea every 4 years, and then I do something about it. I'm just insatiably curious about people. I maybe could have been a talk show host, but I could never do as good a job as Gary Shapiro from the bookshelf. But I'm actually really insatiably curious about people. And so, you know, even extremely mundane things, I'll just be fascinated by and just want to know what people had for lunch. And just everyone's daily existence is always something that compels me. Some, you know, more than others. But I don't have a notebook full of ideas. I more have questions I want to ask people, and every now and then I'll get an idea, but it's usually less of an idea than a feeling that feels like, oh, I need to follow this. I need to follow this interest I have. And then also I think, you know, sometimes fiction writing ends up being an unconscious, like we write what we're unconsciously anxious about or interested in or something, you know. So for me, the idea isn't so much the beginning as some kind of urge to follow a story or follow an anxiety or question.
But, and also place seems to have a lot to do with your books. I think you've had some vivid descriptions of Mexico in Outside of August, right? Or is that where the... No, I guess it's...
Yes.
And you had the... And you have... Well, there's a lot of different locations in your book.
Yeah.
So.
Mexico, and then my last book, The German Bride, was mostly in New Mexico. So,
right.
In the 19th century.
Uh-huh.
Which oddly, I did make the connection. New Mexico in the 19th century and Baja where I've spent a lot of time in the 20th century in certain areas are kind of similar. There are definitely similarities, both, you know, geographic and, you know, it's interesting similarities. But yeah, place is a huge part of how I write and what I'm interested in, and place ends up being prominent in my writing, for sure.
And description of, and visually creating that for the reader. What when do you travel a lot? Do you make notes when you travel? Do you think, oh, I can write sometime, I'm going to use this spot?
Sometimes, but more, you know, I really am not someone who's constant. There's always this stereotype or kind of idea of a writer being unable to live in the moment because they're viewing it from the outside, right? And we're taking notes and, you know, existing outside of the moment. And I actually think I have the kind of opposite personality, where I'm so much in the moment that I'm not paying attention. Actually, it takes me, I can be almost disorientingly in the moment. Like, I forget about time, and I don't have a sense of direction, and it's only later that something will come to me, or as I'm writing, I'll remember a place. It's almost like going into more of a dream state, and then things come up. But I probably could be more conscious about taking notes, but I find that it's all kind of there. It comes when I need it.
You can just kind of visually, you know, close your eyes and find what it looks like again?
Yeah, like sort of sense memory kind of way. But certainly I've been places and thought, this is so particularly inspiring to me, and there's usually something going on that kind of hooks me into a story. Like, place becomes the story, or story becomes the place. So I do find place very inspiring. And there's many places that I would like to write about, and I'm just not sure when that's going to happen.
But how you can work them into your next story.
Yes.
Do you have a next story? I mean, let me ask you this before you answer that one. You have four books that you've published. Are there novels that you wrote that were unpublished first?
Oh, I love when people ask that question. I mean, I love hearing other authors answer that question. I don't. I've published all of my novels, which, uh-huh, you know, I'm glad.
Congratulations.
But thanks. But I always love hearing about people's
unpublished work.
Unpublished novels, and I inevitably want to get my hands on them.
Yeah,
but,
that's right.
I have published all my novels, but my second novel had, a pretty interesting evolution in that I wrote the novel.
That's Outside of August.
This is Outside of August, and a lot of it takes place in Baja, in California. And I wrote a novel, but I wrote a draft fairly quickly, about a year, and I gave it to my editor because I had a contract to write it, and he really basically said, I don't know what you're trying to do with this, and it was not working at all. And I was really upset because it had been a year of writing it, and I felt attached to a lot of it. And what I did is there was about a paragraph or two in it that had some backstory about the characters who were siblings, and I decided to throw out the novel and go back 30 years and change the point of view. So it had been written in the first person, and it was a very linear story, and it mostly took place in Baja. And then I decided to check it, and I went back started 30 years prior, and it was a third person, very different voice, like kind of different.
So you had to rewrite the entire novel, even though
I rewrote the entire novel,
part of the story was the same.
But it was, I rewrote the entire novel, but the character, not even the story was the same, the characters were the same. But they were
so you lied.
Up.
So you actually do have a novel that was not published, even though it was published as a son. The first version of that book.
That's true. Yeah. That is true. The first version never made its way. But, you know, some of it did. Like, some of it made its way, because it's more like the last part of that novel is kind of a truncated version. I don't know. It's hard to explain. But that sort of just chucking it, going back 30 years' time, using the same characters, changing the voice, it really was liberating.
So what about now? Do you have one that you're working on, or it's too soon for another idea? We have 3 years to go.
I think I'm in the percolate. No, I definitely have something. It's percolating. I'm in the percolating phase. I think it would be an exaggeration to say I'm working on it, but it's kind of brewing.
Well, how does it work
for you? I have been taking notes.
Oh, you've been taking notes. So do you like, you're lying in bed at night and all of a sudden you go, oh, and you jump up and you go and...
No, you know, I basically had this little seed of something and I wrote it down and really like a sentence. But it's based on something that kind of happened to me and it happened to me and I actually thought this would be, like it never happens to me. Or something happens and I thought, this would be a great beginning of a thriller. It was this kind of, I thought of it as a film, but then it was just like this feeling I had about it. And then it was just like an encounter with a stranger on the subway. It wasn't anything particularly dramatic, but my imagination started going. And so I did write that down and then it just kind of stayed with me. It's more like the feeling of what I feel like my next novel will be. So I don't know. I'm curious to see when I fully turn my attention to the next one, if this feeling and this kind of beginning of something will make its way there or it will turn into something altogether different. It's still too soon to tell. But I did, when I was running over Labor Day weekend, I'm not much of a runner, but I was running. And
you were running away from a guy in the subway.
Right. Exactly. No, I was running and I did all of a sudden have like five ideas at once about this and I stopped running and I had my iPhone, which I was listening to music with, and I turned it off and I just started jotting down notes on my phone on the side of the road. So that did happen. But usually that is not how it happens.
A Dual Inheritance. It's a novel by Joanna Hirshon, my guest. Thank you so much for chatting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes and you can find us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, the novelist Joanna Hirshon. Her latest book is called A Dual Inheritance. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.